Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Let the record show that this is the time and the place set for the annual rules hearing of the Supreme Court of South Dakota, and that due and legal notice has been given as required by court rules. There have been some proposals submitted, and we will take those up in order if they were received. On a couple of them, where there are more than one proposal under the same subject matter, we'll simply invite the person to speak as to all of them, rather than running back and forth individually when there's probably a lot of overlap. Also, with our tradition, so that the proponent doesn't have to anticipate opposition that never appears, we have the opponent speak before the proponent, which we found that shortens things up. So, with that, this is for those of you that have not been here before, this is a very informal procedure. Feel free to come up and speak at the podium on any rule you wish to, and also you're free to leave when you're done speaking. You don't have to wait till the end of the proceeding. With that, the first one would be an amendment proposed to amend 1526A6. Anybody wish to speak in opposition? There being none, are there any proponents? Mr. Sadazan.
May it please the court, I'll be very brief. This proposal is corrective. It eliminates a reference to a statute that has since been repealed. It's kind of the aftermath of the court's decision to change all appeal timelines to 30 days. Before that, there was a 30-day and a 60-day. This cleans that up. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Any further proponents to Rule 1? The Proposal 1, excuse me. All right. Then the next proposal would be a block submitted by the Board of Bar Examiners. That would be Proposals 2 through 8, I believe. No, 2 through 7, excuse me. Any opponents? If not, are there any proponents? Ms. Sabers.
Thank you. May it please the court. 2 through 7 did indeed originate from the Board of Bar Examiners. We did four main things in our proposals. One, we suggested that in addition to having the dean's certificate filed with the clerk of the Supreme Court, that we also have that certificate filed with the secretary to the Board of Bar Examiners. That way we're on notice as well. We have had some cases come before us now on character and fitness issues, where the applicants are operating under the dean's certificate, even extended dean certificates, and there's been a question as to how long that can continue and how that is terminated or withdrawn. If we were provided with notice of the certificate itself, it would be an easier way for us to become at least part of that process. One of the other things the proposals do, it allows us as the Board of Bar Examiners to withdraw or terminate the certificate. And I actually would like to draw your attention to that language. That's in the Proposal 3, subparagraph 4, because I think I have two potential errors I'd like to call to the court's attention and discuss.
What was that again?
Subparagraph 4 to Proposal Number 3, which is 16.18.2.3.
Okay.
The first, it says that the certificate may be withdrawn by the Board of Bar Examiners. The word withdrawn is actually used for the dean in subparagraph 2. The word terminate is used for your court in subparagraph 3. I think a proper verb for our board would actually be terminate instead of withdraw. So I would suggest that our language be changed to say may be terminated by the Board of Bar Examiners. Because we're not technically granting the certificate, I'm not sure that withdrawn is the correct verb there. The second issue that I would like to draw to your attention, because we struggled with it as a board, when you look at subparagraphs 2 and 3, it allows the dean of the law school and this Supreme Court to revoke that certificate for good cause, for no cause, for any cause, with or without notice. We were reluctant to give ourselves as a board that broad of a grant of power. We narrowed our language to say that our board was restricted. We could only withdraw that certificate for character and fitness issues. The more I think about that language, I'm concerned that there's a possible confidentiality breach. When the certificate is filed with the Supreme Court clerk, it becomes a matter of public record that, let's say, Susan Sabers is operating under a certificate. If for some reason the Board of Bar Examiners then revokes, withdraws, terminates my certificate, according to the rule, the only reason the board could have done that is on a character and fitness issue. So I think at the risk of granting us too broad authority to revoke that certificate, I think it may be better if paragraph 4 was reworded to mirror the language in 2 and 3. Otherwise, I am afraid that we are flagging that it is a true character and fitness concern, and my concern would be that that's a potential confidentiality breach for a process that is otherwise deemed confidential.
So you end that sentence with bar examiners and delete the words due to character and fitness issues?
Yes.
All right. Okay.
Does the notice then that the rest of that sentence need to mirror it as well then?
I think it would be best if the entire paragraph mirrored paragraphs 2 and 3. Then there's really no red flag given for the reason for the revocation. The third issue we tried to address, and it reads a little silly. We're in that same rule. We're in the final sentence of paragraph 1. It says, the Board of Bar Examiners announces the results of the bar examination by letter to the student, informing him or her that she passed or failed the examination. It seems like that makes just good common sense, and maybe that's not necessary. We did have an issue with the law school where an issue arose on an applicant. The law school had extended a certificate beyond the second taking of the bar exam, beyond our announcement of the results of that second bar exam. And the issue became, what do you mean by announcing the results of the bar exam? Do you actually mean whether they passed or failed the test itself? Or do you mean you've finished your character and fitness inquiry, you've deemed them subject to admission, and we recommend their name for admission to this court? Our position was always that when the rule said we announced the results, we meant whether you passed or failed the test. When we sent you a letter saying congratulations, you passed the test. Our concern was the rules as written would allow an applicant to fail the bar exam the first time, continue with a dean certificate, take the bar exam a second time, continue with the dean certificate, and then be under a full inquiry of character and fitness. For instance, we could say that a hearing is appropriate, schedule the matter for a hearing. Well, when the dean actually issues the certificate initially, he says, I deem this person to be of good moral character and fitness. Then you've got a group of the five bar examiners saying, we have some character and fitness concerns. We would like to hold a hearing on this matter. And the two seem not to run together very well. You've got one person saying good moral character and fitness is there, and you've got one group saying we need to take a look. It's not really an innocent until presumed guilty presumption either, because our rules, specifically 1616.6.2, say that it's the applicant who bears the burden to demonstrate the good moral character and fitness. So there's no presumption that you're automatically morally fit to practice law. So it truly is, the burden is truly on the applicant, his or herself. So we thought that may be more appropriate to specifically say, when we say announce the bar exam results, that's what we mean. We mean we tell you whether you pass or fail that test the second time around. And then if we decide to conduct a character and fitness issue hearing, then that certificate should automatically terminate. And that, I think, would solve some of the problems we've seen lately. Hypothetically, the rule would allow, I think most of us in the practice read these, excuse me, as the intern rules. You're a second-year law student. You go to a firm or to a governmental agency in the middle of your law school career, and they let you do a few things, and it's a pretty neat experience. What we're seeing in the real world is folks who are 2 years post-graduation, who have not yet passed a bar exam, who are practicing in court without a supervising lawyer. And so our proposals were to tighten up that process a bit. The fourth issue, and probably the most important.
So my understanding then under that sentence, then in the subsection 1 that you have recommended be inserted. Is that still the language you want?
It is, Your Honor. At the top of paragraph one, four lines down, it talks about the expiration of the certificate, and it says, or until the announcement by the bar examiners of this state of the results of the bar examination. So we're just trying to further define that language so that it's not open to debate any longer as to what the announcement of the results mean. The fifth issue was the supervision. I had personally always read the rule to mean that if the intern was to practice in a court of law, the supervision by the lawyer meant physical presence without the consent. Issues arose whether that was truly happening. One of our biggest concerns really was, what is informed consent? Are folks really going to their clients and saying, you're not going to get Susan Sabers with 15 years of experience. Instead, you're going to get a second-year law student who hasn't taken the bar, who hasn't passed the bar, who has an entire year left of law school, and they're going to be flying solo. Every time I try to sell an intern's involvement to one of my clients to get their consent for that involvement, my final thing is, and I promise I'll be sitting in the chair right next to them, and if anything goes wrong, I'll be there hopefully to fix the problem. If the court disagrees, that's clearly your prerogative. Our concern is that we do have unlicensed non-students practicing law, and we wanted to tighten that up a bit. So
we think it's being abused. I guess I just go back on my own experience, and I remember at one point my supervisor, lawyer, said, take the file and go in there and handle this. And it's a great learning experience when you have to fly solo as opposed to knowing there's someone at your back. So there's pros and cons, so I'm curious to know if there's some abuse of this process.
The combined concern of our board was yes, Your Honor, that there was some abuse, that folks were using as a substitute to passing the bar exam and to passing a character and fitness review. That was our concern. As to having someone actually sitting there, when I'm sitting there, I'm actually more willing to let the intern take on a bigger job. If I'm not going, the intern's going to do very little, very minor hearings, very unimportant issues. But if an intern's written a brief for me and they're the ones that have read all the summary judgment cases and written the brief and really up on the issue, I'm perfectly comfortable going and watching, might not say a word, but I'm perfectly comfortable. Summary judgment hearing's a pretty big issue for an intern. I think that supervision may actually improve the quality of the experience that those folks are getting, because maybe us as bosses would be willing to let them take on a little harder issue.
It's a little different if it's, for example, in a state's attorney situation where someone's sent over to do a preliminary hearing, and if they blow the preliminary hearing and the case gets dismissed, it could always be recharged again.
Correct.
So it's a little, the standards vary depending upon the kind of work that the intern is going to be doing.
And we did strike, especially in light of your concern, Justice Konenkamp, I should direct your attention, 1618.2.4, which is the proposed rule number 4 change. In subparagraph 2 near the end, I don't know if you're in the Bar Newsletter. It's on page 11 of the Bar Newsletter. I'm not sure what the easiest way is to direct you. We did strike the language saying that if it's not a critical stage of the proceedings, that they should be able to go alone. So if you do have that concern, Your Honor, you may want to reinstate that language and allow for that flying solo at non-critical stages. I would point out that the rules as published did not draw an objection from any of the state's attorney's offices, any of the public defender's office. So I was expecting that we would hear from those groups if they did have an issue with it, and we didn't hear that. Our attorney general, my classmate, Mr. Jackley, is here. You did receive a letter from his office talking about the supervision issue. And I would like to say for the record that was an oversight on our part. We did not mean that Mr. Jackley needed to be permanently and physically present every time an intern from his office went out and abroad. And we did agree, we 100% have no objection to the addition of their suggested language for that letter. It comes down to, if the court is comfortable with applicants who have not passed a bar exam practicing in open court without a license and without a supervising lawyer, we don't have a dog in that fight. That's for you to make that decision. Our concern was that we've seen some issues that we do believe were abusive of the rule, and we wanted to tighten that down for that reason. Any other questions? Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any other proponents for the block of proposals from the Board of Bar Examiners. Okay, there being none, we'll move along then to proposal number 8. And although these do come from one source, I think because they're so diverse in their proposals, we'll take them separately. Proposal number 8 would amend 1915-1 under the federal designation 701. Are there any opponents to this? Any proponents? Number 9 would amend 1915-2 or Rule 702. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Now, proposal number 10 would amend 1915-3, or also known as Rule 703 on the federal side. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Proposal number 11 would amend 1915-4 or Rule 704. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Proposal 12 would it's entitled adoption of a new rule on both civil procedure and criminal procedure. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Yes, Ms. Dilges.
I'm not really opponent or proponent, just if you had any questions on the what we had put in our letter about clarifying what was included in for the new proposed Rule 12 and 13, I guess, 13 as well, but including the jury instructions, specifically putting that in there. If you had any questions, I was here to answer those.
No. I don't. Is there any rest of the court? Okay. Thank you. Any other proponents? 12 and 13. Magistrate Mark Marshall.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief, as is my usual practice. These rules were developed on behalf of the UJS Court Reporters Committee that was created to promote the selection and retention of court reporters in South Dakota. I believe as a result of this court's concern about the ongoing integrity of the record in light of the push to become more economic and more efficient and adopt digital reporting, the rules as proposed attempt to ensure the integrity of the record to prevent a transcript from that CD that you get in the Second or Seventh Circuit from Court Smart or for the record to be transcribed by anyone other than a court reporter, a court recorder, or an employee of the UJS system. I wholeheartedly adopt the recommendations for clarifications provided by the Attorney General's office. And I think, especially with regard to Rule 13 or Proposal 13, that those recommendations meet any objection that other opponents may have filed in writing. Attorney General Jackley's comments made clear that it's only the transcript of a record developed in a UJS proceeding that is subject to that rule.
Okay. Might we invite your committee to resubmit this, you know, with the corrective language in it so that there's no question as to what you're proposing?
I would be delighted to do that, Your Honor, and you'll have that by the end of the week.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
We might do the same for the proposals from the Board of Bar Examiners, since you talked about several changes rather than trust our memories or notes jotted down. We'd invite you to do the same thing within a reasonable time. Okay. All right. The next proposal would be number 14. To adopt a new rule to number South Dakota evidence rules to conform to the federal rules of evidence. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Proposal number 15, to adopt a new rule to adopt federal rules of evidence 412. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Proposal number 16, to adopt a new rule similar to the Rule 705 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, Are there any opponents? Any proponents? Okay. Proposal number 17, which would be designated a new rule to adopt Rule 807 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. Are there any opponents? Any proponents? And I believe that is all the proposals that we have before us. So, there being nothing further to consider, unless anybody has any closing comments, we are in recess. Thank you.